Welcome to the Starkey Multifamily Meetup. I have with me Phil Capron. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hey, what's up, Reed? Glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so Phil, let's start. Let's just get going. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay. So we're here talking about multifamily. So I guess folks potentially care about that. Hopefully, if they're listening, right? So I've been investing in multifamily for a couple of years now. Portfolio is just over 200 units, got another 50 and change under contract that'll close in the next month or so. You know, I started out like most people in real estate, you know, reading The Rich Dad, Poor Dad, The Millionaire Real Estate Investor, and, you know, some other of the old standards, saying, how do I do this? I understand academically that real estate is a good thing. You know, and a lot of people become very, very wealthy through real estate. How do I do that? So what that looked like for me was separating from the United States Navy in 2012. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And when I was in, I took a real estate agent course for fun on a training trip after I bought my own home. And you know, I said, well, why don't I just do that? So I started selling homes to my buddies from my unit and other units we worked with. And you know, was pretty good at it. You know, coming from a military background and sort of applying that tenacity to residential real estate sales, I did really well. I was exposed to a gentleman who was flipping houses, and I sort of, you know, asked for his help. I said, hey, you know, I'd like to do that. Maybe you want a partner? He said, no, you are just my agent. That's it. That rubbed me a little bit wrong. I don't like being talked to that way. So despite that setback, maybe it was the fuel on my fire, I went and, you know, dug into the podcasts and the books and started flipping houses, flipped a few dozen. And, you know, thankfully the right opportunity sort of presented itself to get into a small multifamily building. And that's when, you know, my life really changed. So that brings us to a few years ago and more or less present day. So I'll stop there and see if, you've got anything question-wise, or if that's a decent, you know, way to get started.
That's a perfect intro. So let's talk about that multifamily, because you and I talked a little bit before we started this, and you kind of said you fell into it. So
I fell into it.
Let's hear that story, because that's got to be interesting.
It's a decent one. It's a decent one if, you know, if I do say so myself. You know, as the old adage goes, the teacher will arrive when the student is ready. You know, we have the very similar stories in the way that we've known that this is a thing for a while, like a decade. And why didn't I do this sooner? And I don't have a great answer for you. Is it fear? Is it the perceived lack of knowledge? Is it not the right opportunity? Or is it just that my life was a little too good the way it was to take the leap? And I'm sure it's some combination of all of those. But what this looked like for me was, you know, 2017, I was still selling houses, still flipping a lot of houses. And, you know, one of my good friends, a contractor, you know, he'd amassed a, you know, a portfolio of about 30 or 35 single families and small multis. So when I saw something hit the MLS, the realtor MLS, that was 13 units with a couple of storage units, you know, on one parcel of land, like 2.5 acres in a submarket I really like, and have sold a lot of and flipped a lot of, I said, hey, I want to investigate this. And I took my buddy over there. They had it listed for, I think, $925,000, give or take. And, you know, it looked on its face like a reasonable deal. So I took my buddy and we toured the units, and he came in with an offer of like 825, and we went back and forth, and they weren't able to come to terms. The last counter was somewhere around 850 from our side. And so the other broker, you know, calls me and said, you know, hey, you know, we can't get the price that the seller wants. In an attempt to help, he'll do owner financing. So I called my buddy, and I think that this is going to be what seals the deal. I said, he'll do owner financing. My buddy informs me, I don't care. I have my own money.
Okay.
well, that doesn't help me. And I was really looking forward to the $27,000 commission. So I'm kind of bummed with that news that he doesn't care. Mm-hmm. I call the other broker back and let him know he doesn't care. And the broker says, well, darn, do you know anyone that would buy it with owner financing? And I said, well, would he sell it to me? I think there's some money to be made here. Like I said, I know the market very well and I see the potential. And he said, yeah, bring $100,000 down and he'll sell it to you. And he'll finance the other, you know, 800 and change. I'm like, fantastic. Now I just need to find out where I'm getting 100 grand because I've got maybe 25 in the bank. And so I call one of my buddies who we'd done a lot of flips together and said, hey man, we're going to do this. We're going to be 50-50 partners. This is how much money we're going to make. It's going to be great. He said, cool, sign me up. All the way from California, and I'm in Virginia. I don't think I mentioned that. So I go and I do my inspections and do a really poor job, just exceptionally poor job of due diligence, like catastrophically poor. And, you know, release my contingencies. We're up 10 days out from closing. And my buddy calls from California. He said, you know what? I thought about it. I like flips. I like getting my money back quick. I don't think I want this long-term thing. I'm sorry, I'm out. Uh-oh. Yeah. So I need 75 large in 10 days. Cool. So I get on the phone and start calling people, looking for anyone that'll partner with me on this deal. And I go to the seller. He's about 80 years old. We go sit on his dock overlooking the bay, get a couple cups of coffee. I, you know, let him know, sir, I'm really sorry, but I'm not able to make good on my obligations. My partner's backed out and he was bringing most of the down payment. You know, I can't do this. So I let him know that I wasn't able to perform because my buddy was bringing most of the down payment. And, you know, I didn't want him to be like injured based on my inability to perform. So I proposed that he take my earnest money and relist it on the market and try to get his price. And, you know, he said, well, what can you do, young fella? And, you know, like I said, I had like 25 in the bank, but I got nervous. I was like, you know, I could do 40. And he stuck out his paw and he said, okay, we'll close next week as planned. So now I got to go find a bunch of money because I was nervous by telling him I only had 25. So I'd put some calls in and, you know, a few people get back to me, a couple buddies, and one wanted to do 30 and the other one wanted to do 10. I was like, if I'm raising money, why don't I just raise all the money? So I closed on a piece of property for $900,000 with $5,074.01 of my own money, essentially the closing cost. So that was pretty cool. Yeah. But before my first buddy backed out for the 75, I had negotiated some pretty cool terms with the seller. You know, I said, hey, this is my first multifamily. What happens if the tenants mutiny and everyone moves out? You know, what am I going to do? I need some money in the bank. And I negotiated the first 6 months that I would only pay the principal portion of the owner financing. So instead of a almost $5,000 a month payment, it was like $800 for the first 6 months. So the first month, no payment, and then $800 vice 5,000. So like the first 7 months, I think I brought in a little over $45,000 in cash flow. So what? I paid both my buddies back and I'm into a $900,000 piece of property for pretty much nothing. Paid myself back, ROI infinite. Then I kind of got the bright idea once the true mortgage payment started hitting that I would raise the rents. Well, that's the wrong time to do it. I should have raised the rents the first thing, right? So, you know, I created some vacancy, had some rough months, you know, had a tenant skip town in the middle of the night because they couldn't make rent, pipe burst, flooded out the whole half of the duplex, big insurance claim. It was a nightmare. You know, I definitely got bruised and bloodied on this deal. But what I got was an education. And would I have been ready to do that in 2010? I don't really know, but I wasn't ready to do it in 2017 either, all the stuff that came up, all the stuff I did wrong. But that was my tuition, that was my education. And I actually got paid to do it instead of paying to do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was my first deal. I made a lot of mistakes, but, you know, it taught me a lot of things. So I wouldn't trade it. I might end up selling that property because it still is a lot of headaches. It's just, you know, it's not a big multifamily building that I can turn over to a property management company and not worry about. I still get a lot of calls. I still have to go out there a lot. You know, it's making good money. So for now, it's, you know, it's cool. And how I got into this crazy world of multifamily.
So I got a couple questions came up on that. So I want to clarify, you did a principal only.
Principal only. Everything's negotiable. You know, you hear about interest only payments.
Yeah.
The interest is a lot. I wanted to go for a little. So I said, how about I just pay the principal portion? And they agreed. Yeah.
And interest only, you still owe the same amount. Mm-hmm. You know, principal only, that's fascinating. Yeah. I've never even thought of crossing that. You know, it's never even crossed my mind. So, and then the second thing that I'm interested about, so you didn't even really know what a syndication was when you bought this apartment. So you kind of put some of the pieces together, you know, by yourself.
Yep. Which is fascinating. So what it was is, you know, without getting on too big of a jag into syndication law, if you're going to take money from somebody for a piece of real estate and they are not involved, that is a syndication. They're counting on you to get them a return. Mm-hmm. If they are actively involved in the management, the decision making, blah, 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 that can be a joint venture, a general partnership kind of agreement. And that's legal and cool. So what I did to avoid any of that kind of drama is I did a signature loan with my buddies. They were in no way connected to the real estate. The $30,000 and the $10,000, I just said, hey, I'm going to pay you back in like 3 months, $10,000. Cool. They got paid back first. And then the $30,000, hey, I'm going to pay you back within the first year, either out of this original first 7 months, or if something happens and we run short, you know, I'm projecting there's going to be enough cash flow, and you know me, I've got flips going on, I got this, that, and the other thing. He said, yeah, I believe you, you know. And so that was my workaround on that.
So they don't have an upside then? They just have
the they're out. They're out, man. It's 100% mine with none of my own money into it at this point.
But you were just giving them a straight interest rate and then straight up. That's awesome to get for sure.
And it worked for them. And that's the key to structuring, investments is every investor has different goals. Some of them are more risk averse than others. Some of them want to gamble a little bit for some possibility of upside. And if you are out there raising money, first, know the law and know what you can and can't do. And second, you know, instead of being so concerned about what you have to offer, find out what they want. And potentially you can craft an opportunity around their needs.
Yeah, that's, you know, one of my favorite parts about this concept of syndication is it doesn't matter what you have or don't have. Mm-hmm. Just find that piece and put it in there. So if you need somebody with money, you say, okay, well, I need somebody with money, and there you go. Or if you need somebody with, you know, who can sign on the loan, you bring him in as a key principal. Or, you know, maybe you need somebody to help you manage the asset. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter what you don't have. You just bring those pieces in, and it's you kind of did it, but you didn't know what you were doing.
To your point, that's my favorite part of the business now is assembling great teams. I acknowledge that I'm not the best at probably anything, but for whatever reason, I'm blessed with either a natural ability or a learned ability over the years to find the best people and to bring everyone on to the same vision and have people rowing the same direction. That's contractors, property managers, investors, net worth individuals, brokers, lenders. Somehow I find a way to make it work for everybody. And that is the key to my success, if you want to call it success, without like sounding braggadocious. Like, you know, I've had a pretty good run at it, and, you know, showing no signs of stopping anytime soon. So to me, that's success. It's a lot more than I was doing in 2014. It's like that, you know, flipping a house here and there.
Yeah, putting the team together is definitely critical. You know, even on my retail days and into building houses or flipping houses, it all is critical. you know, I was fortunate enough to have a boss point that out to me. You know, I said something, maybe of a low confidence comment to him, and he said, "Don't sell yourself short." He says, "You built that team." You know, I think I said something like, "I don't even feel like I do anything at the store." And he says, "Well, you built the team and the people that are doing it right." And but anyway,
here's a caveat to that, and it's a lesson that I've paid for handsomely over my career, is you can't be a great manager of average people.
Yeah.
So if you spend more time on the front end, doing a little due diligence, ensuring alignment of interest, and making sure that you're providing an opportunity for those individuals that are integral to your team to be the most, you know, the biggest that they care to be, and provide opportunities for growth, they're going to stick with you.
Yeah. Great is a perfect book to cover the topic. Have you read that book?
I have not. You're so well read. I'm embarrassed with our pre-show conversation.
I'll try and edit some of that out.
Send me a list, man. See, you're like my fourth grade teacher. Send me my summer reading list, please.
Yeah. Good to Great talks about major companies that did very good with their CEOs in place. But there's when they left, some of them dropped and some of them kept going up. So what was the difference in those people? And the key difference was the ones that fell off the cliff were the ones that did everything themselves. So they made all the decisions and everything had to go through them. The ones that kept going are the ones that said, "Hey, you know, if it's less than $100,000, make the decision," or, you know, "I trust you to do this." And they built the team that made the decisions instead of one CEO hedging everything. If you're doing everything yourself, that means if you get sick or, you know, anything, everything fails.
So this multifamily business is passive income, not "I'm going to keep working really, really hard" income. If you want to do that, go flip in wholesale houses. You can make a lot of money, you're really rich, but you're never going to be wealthy.
Well, that's the funny, you know, the funny thing about, you know, flipping houses. So you have the same story of flipping houses in the beginning. I did that in my head as a passive investment, and then realized I was working just as hard as I had ever worked before with more risk. You know, if I worked that hard for an employer, at least I get a paycheck no matter what. Here, I only get paid if I do good. So it was interesting. So let's transition into your next deal. So you're doing good on this 13 unit, right?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's a fair amount of headaches, and I'm not completely opposed to unloading it, but I've got fully amortizing 30-year owner finance debt on it. So I got to scratch my head and be like, "Do I really want to potentially lose this? You know, great debt, area is really up and coming. How can I remove some of these headaches and make myself a little more passive in it and hang on?" Because I know that if I hang on to it for another 10 or 15 years, I'm going to be really happy I did. But right now at the rate that I'm growing, it's requiring too much brain damage and bandwidth relative to what it's doing for me. So yeah. I'll figure it out.
Can you pass that debt on to the new buyer?
That's a great question. And that's why it's important to know your loan docs. So I actually have an appointment with my attorney tomorrow morning to go over all of those loan docs. And if I do list it for sale, if I can advertise 30-year fully amortizing owner financing, you know, with no, you know, appraisals, credit checks, all that stuff, that's pretty valuable.
Yeah. So when did you decide you wanted to move into another, you know, to continue growing? So because you had the 13.
Immediately. Because I said, "Wow, they were right. This really works." You know, so I wanted to as quickly as possible get into the next deal. But you know that the market's competitive, so you can't just get into any deal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was what year was this?
Well, it was 2017.
Okay. So yeah, so it was just real recent then.
Yeah, recent.
So tell me about the second deal. What transitioned in there? So you started looking, you know, how were you going to brokers?
I'm going to attack your question in a little bit of a indirect way. There's a lot of people that say that there are no good deals on LoopNet and nothing good is on the market and so on and so forth. Everything I've bought until this 20 plus 20-plex I have under contract closes in July has been on the market. And my second deal, which is my most successful to date, it was 108 apartments across 6 buildings in a submarket I really like. It was listed for $5.5 million, something like that. And, you know, when I started engaging with the broker, they had already had a contract or two fall out. So they're frustrated. Seller's frustrated. And I go and tour everything and find a lot of deferred maintenance. But what I also find, and what you will find with mom and pop type outfits, is there's a lot of room for improvement with efficiency. Rents are probably a little low. And, you know, that's for me where I want to play in this industry. So we ended up, contracting the building or I did that rather, because at this point I didn't have any partners. I got a proof of funds letter from the bank based on our flipping business that said I had $1 million or the company had $1 million, whatever. And went and put this thing under LOI and sort of built my team from there. And it started with, you know, a property manager in one of the top real estate firms in the area. Also brought in some net worth there. It was important in liquidity. Then the next stop for building that deal was finding a commercial broker with like 30 years experience who was going to shepherd us through my first big, major acquisition. And then the last, but maybe most important piece of the puzzle was the Class A contractor who was going to do over $500,000 in renovations across these 100 units. And it's the same guy that I mentioned that didn't want the 13-plex that I bought.
Oh, no.
When I first went to him, I said, hey, bro, we're going to buy 100 apartments. He just laughed in my face. He's like, you're a house flipper. What makes you think you can buy 100 apartments? I don't know, these other people are doing it. Why can't we? You know, I've got a good deal here. He's like, I don't know whether you do or you don't. But then when we brought in the broker, he's like, whoa, you've struck gold with this. And, you know, as we were structuring the deal, there was some debate on, did Phil really get a good deal on this? We got our answer when the appraisal came in at $1.55 million higher as is than my purchase price. So I'm like, did I do good, guys? They're like, yep, you did okay. We each added 400 grand to our net worth just by signing on the dotted line. That's kind of cool. And then they did a pro forma or post renovation appraisal, and that came in at like 2.5 higher than our purchase and renovation budget. So we've been working on that now for the better part of a year, and the results are they're astronomical. My one building that was kind of my favorite of the six, the in-place rents were $525 to $550, and my pro forma said that we could get to $625 for the rents. We flipped, I think, 12 of 30, and they have flown off the market less than a week market time at $700 and a $35 a month, utility charge. So you can figure out what that does to one's NOI, but I'll give you a hint. It almost doubles the value of the building, what we've done there between, raising those rents, adding the rubs, and reducing management inefficiency. I mean, we're crushing that building. Another one's like a 12-plex. So the acquisition was around $450, put about $150 into it, major overhaul. Those rents in place were $700. For 2-bedroom, 1-baths, but they also have garages and washer and dryer hookups, which is very uncommon for the submarket. So we flipped them almost to flip quality, and the new rents are $1,100 a month, and they pay their own water. Wow. So that that valuation at like a 6.75 cap, not only did we, rapidly increase NOI, but we've also repositioned the class, the building, from like a solid C to like a B minus or even B. I mean, it's a nice building now, very well located with all the amenities. So the new value on that one, since we've done our business plan, is we're all in at 600,000, and our appraised value right now is 1.2 and change. And as we work down the line on the other couple buildings that we really haven't done too much damage on yet, it's going to be similar. So I wouldn't be surprised if we have an appraised value of the portfolio of 8 million and the next 12 months. So absolutely grand slam home run on that one.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what was the seller's reaction when they saw that appraisal come in?
They were just so sick of fighting, and I kind of glossed over this, but there's a reason why I got such a good deal, and it's important. So I'll double back to it. They'd already had a couple contracts fall through. They were coming up on a loan event. It was the heirs to the gentleman who had built all this property in the 70s and 80s. And they'd already refied out. They didn't want anything to do with the properties. They just wanted out, My offer was not the highest, but this story that I got the brokers to buy into, which was the truth, is that, look, we're with one of the top residential brokers in the area, in the state. We've got this Class A contractor who owns a lot of units in the submarket. We flip a couple dozen houses a year in this submarket. Like, we are the guys. Everyone else is going to come in and retrade you. They're going to give you a higher offer. They're going to do the inspection. They're going to lower it. They're going to ask for a bunch of concessions. This is my offer, and it's my offer. I will not retrade you. It is what it is, unless one of them is falling into a sinkhole, or there's a meth lab or something else just truly catastrophic I couldn't have known, we're closing. And to solve the problems of your broker and your seller, a lot of times that is the most important aspect for them, is knowing that in 60 days they're getting their money. And that's what we delivered. And, got a ton of equity for it.
So when you're saying broker, are you talking about for the loan side of it?
No, I'm talking about the listing broker. The listing broker wants to know that you are going to close and they're going to get commission.
Well, you said you had worked with another broker. Did you bring in your own selling broker too? So you had a broker on both sides?
No.
Okay. So when you say broker, you meant...
It was funny because I was having this conversation with one of my coaching students earlier today, who is a broker. So when I go talk to the listing broker, what do I do? I'm like, what would you do if it was your listing? Sure, it would be nice to have half of that commission at, 4, 5, 6 million, whatever price point you're talking about, but you kind of need that gatekeeper. So I would not jeopardize losing a fantastic deal that adds 1.5 million to your partnership net worth over, let's just say, if it was a 2.5% listing, like 100 or 125 grand.
So you knew you wanted to do this for 10 years.
Yeah, but I didn't, the books say you buy real estate and you hold it. But when you're looking at it and you don't have a tremendous amount of means to get started, are you putting 20 grand down to buy a $100,000 piece of property conventional to make $200 a month? Like, cash on cash wise, that's decent, but that's not getting you retired, right? So that's why people get into wholesaling and flipping. But through the power of syndication and partnerships and solving problems, you can, really ramp that up very rapidly through multifamily. And for whatever reason, I just didn't get it. I didn't get it for a lot of years. I read it. I heard about it. You don't really see many people doing it. Multifamily is a lot more in vogue these days than it was. Mm-hmm. People are making a lot of money in multifamily. But you're like out with friends and stuff, and how many people do you run into that are like, yeah, I own a lot of apartment buildings. We're a rarer bird.
Yeah.
You're going to be out and about, and you're going to meet a lot of people in your day-to-day life that are flipping houses or that own 2, 3, 5 rentals. And those are great things. I'm glad that they're doing them. But the folks that really get into multifamily and amass great portfolios and great wealth, they're a lot fewer and farther between.
Yeah, I agree. So So was it a confidence thing? I mean, did you just feel like you needed a little bit more information, or, you know, as I've heard it called, analysis paralysis? Like you just, you know, you're always wanting to do it, but pulling that trigger, there's a huge step between looking at deals and pulling the trigger and completing it.
Absolutely. It's a limiting belief that I think affects a lot of people about what is possible for you. You're capable of a lot more than you think that you are, because your brain and all of its best intentions is trying to keep you in comfort. It doesn't want you to fall on your face. You know, the ego is a powerful force. You know, the idea of having a roof over your head and, you know, all of your basic needs met, your brain is going to really want you to avoid anything that might sacrifice or jeopardize those securities. So when it comes to like flipping a house, 100,000, people can wrap their brain around that. We're talking about an apartment complex for 5 million. It's a big step. But in reality, the vast majority of that is going to be leveraged through a bank or through a government agency at really favorable terms, the bigger you get. And then, you know, on the 5 million example, at an 80% leverage point, you need 1 million. But it doesn't have to be your million. You have to craft a deal as such that either partners or passive investors can deploy that $1 million and get a really nice, stable, relatively secure rate of return for doing so. Once you crack that code, it becomes easy. But we, you know, we spent a long time talking about this earlier. What changed in me? I don't really know. It's just that accidental sort of purchase of the 13 unit showed me that it was possible. I had been reading about it for a decade, but doing that, I was like, whoa, this actually really does work. How do I do another? And the 108 unit, like I said, I didn't really have means to buy that. But I crafted a deal so good that I was forced to find a way.
Yeah.
So I guess for something actionable for the folks out there, try to find out what you do better than anyone else within this business. Are you a master networker? Do you have access to a lot of folks with a lot of money? Maybe you're a capital raiser. Are you a contractor? Can you help with the improvement? Are you a property manager? Are you a real estate broker who can be a gatekeeper to deals other people might not see? Where do you fit? And once you understand that and the value you're bringing to a potential team, you can create your team around you and go and do some really radical things that you would not be able to do if you're just flying solo.
Yeah. So did you say you had coaching students?
Yeah. Yep.
So that might be an interesting way to look at it. So I would imagine you've got some coaching students, and maybe this is an inappropriate question, so decide that when I ask it.
Okay.
But I'm sure that you have some that, how do I say this appropriately, that may not ever take a step toward actually doing a deal. So they sound ambitious, and you talk to them and they're like, oh yeah, I'm all in, I'm doing this. And then you go, okay, well, take steps A, B, C, and D. And then you talk to them and they're like, oh, I was busy, you know, I had to work late, my family had this going on. What is your advice to those? Because I see those a lot, and it's frustrating because you see that they want something really bad. Mm-hmm. But what's the difference between that guy and the guy who just does it? So like, there's no excuses. You don't hear, oh, well, I was busy last week. You're like, I got it done. I made it happen.
All right. So not inappropriate at all. I get students that are, so just to nip it in the bud, I get students with all levels of experience. Some of them I'm so stoked. You know, I was just on the phone with a guy who's got 50 units, but he understands, because he's been around, that, you know, I could continue to kind of do what I did, is, you know, kind of figure it out. But, you know, your network is your net worth. And to have access to folks that have done some really profound things within the industry, that have all the property management, the contracting, the lending, you know, the, hey, this happened, what do I do? Contacts is invaluable, you know? And that's why he elected to get into coaching versus continuing to, you know, go it alone. I have had students that are the model that you're talking about. They're never going to do anything. And I don't have patience for that because I'm not a coach to like be rich. Like it's worth my time. I'll put it that way. Right. I do it because I love doing what we're doing right now. I love hopping on with other high level people and talking about real estate and figuring out how to solve problems and figuring out how to create the life of their dreams. The people that don't do it, that aren't going to do it, that find an excuse, you know, Gary Keller, you know, the founder of Keller Williams, you know, says, and I love Keller Williams, says you can have reasons or you can have results. You can't have both. And another mentor and friend of mine who we did a, you know, a little webinar together last night, his name's Matty A. He's a big flipper. The six-figure flipper is his handle, his website. You know, something I wrote down from our time together last night that was so profound to me is that in a certain point in his life, he realized that his video did not match his audio. He was out there talking a big game. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be that. Just wait and see. But he was not living it. So if you're hanging out, watching TV, making excuses, I mean, it can be anything. No offense to TV or Xbox or, you know, Game of Thrones or whatever. Ultimately, in life, you're going to do what you want to do. When we took over this D-class apartment building, I was walking it with my contractor, who I've mentioned you know, a few times now, a great friend of mine. And there's 70-inch TVs in apartments that rent for $500 a month. And the conditions are beyond deplorable. So we leave the units and I say, Darren, how do we help these people? How do we make their lives better? And he said, Phil, they're living exactly the lives that they want to live. If they wanted something different, they would change something. So to quote Maddie, make sure that your audio matches your video or your video matches your audio. Whatever you're saying you want to do, make sure that you're actually out there doing it, or you're going to find yourself unfulfilled and you're going to find yourself reverting to those excuses. And some people, they're not in a place in their life, no judgment, they're not in a place in their life to make a change. Because the mortal, you mentioned the book Good to Great, the mortal enemy of great is good. If you have it good, it's really unlikely that you're going to have the motivation to change, especially if you know you've been stuck in that pattern for a while. You have to be very conscious and deliberate about it, and you have to have some really compelling reasons as to why you're doing whatever you're doing, because it's radical. It goes against what your brain wants, which is to keep you safe and secure and in a pattern and doing what you always done, because they notice that that keeps you alive, right? So to tap in a little bit to my military experience, you know, the first day of special ops training, the instructor says, look to your left, look to your right. If you're lucky enough to be here at graduation day, those two men won't be. And it turned out to be absolutely true. What was different about me than those men? Think a lot about it, because I watch guys that are, you know, faster than me, stronger than me, what I thought was tougher than me, and they cracked. They went by the wayside. They couldn't do it. You know, they allowed themselves to succumb to what was inside. It's not the external that matters so much. It's about what's in here. So what keeps people, and if you want to talk about multifamily or financial freedom in whatever avenue you're pursuing it, look to your left, look to your right, look to the front, look to the back, multiply it by a factor of 100. And if you make it, they're not going to be there. The special ops is really tough. Really, really, really tough. Really tough, right? Mm-hmm. But by the time you get to special ops selection, you know, we know you're really tough. You had to make it through a lot of hoops to get there. So if you're on your couch cramming Oreos in your mouth and you see something about, you know, the Navy or the Army or the Air Force, and you're like, yeah, I want to do that, but that's as far as you get. That's a lot of people that you know, we'll read one book or listen to one podcast, or, you know, next step up from there is they go to one event and they continue listening to the podcast or reading the books, whatever. But they still, they haven't even enlisted. So, you know, go to the recruiter, see if you can actually make those qualifications, you know, then maybe you're actually out looking at deals. When you actually make it to boot camp, that's sort of where you're at. But you've got to get through there, and you've got to be a top performer to keep, you know, your spot in special ops training. And you get there, and then at that point, and I would say that maybe, you know, a top coaching program would be about, you know, day one of special ops training. Look to your left, look to your right. You know, I'd say that more than half, two-thirds, three-quarters, they're not going to make it to the ultimate goal. My hope is that they at least do something that is better than working a job for 40 years and looking back with nothing to show for it. If they fail but rack up a few duplexes and quads and, you know what I mean, can fund their kids' college, can buy the vacation house, can, you know, do whatever it is that is their why, even if they didn't make financial freedom to the level that we define it, like, I'm really happy for them. But the folks that make it to the pinnacle, there's not a lot of them. And I'm not there, you know, but I'm taking massive action and I'm working on it. You know, I'll cross $10,000 a month in passive income this year. Like, if you told me a few years ago that that was in the cards for me, I wouldn't have believed you. I thought I just would have to flip, you know, two dozen homes and freaking be racing around seven cities and 10 job sites at a time to make, you know, those kind of numbers happen. But now it's the assets that are doing the work. It's my property manager that's doing the work. It's my contractor partner. And I help, you know, I go and, you know, I'm out at the job sites and I'm doing stuff, but it's not four or five job sites a day like it is in the flipping world. So, you know, that's sort of like my military analogy. But what is stopping people? And this will be the last one. I'll get off this jag. You know, picture that you're in a big flying tin can and, you know, U.S. Army Free Fall School. The ramp to the C-130 starts to open over Arizona sky. All these beautiful colors because you've just been basically inhaling pure oxygen for the last 20 minutes. And I tell you what, it's good. The colors look good. You feel good. Oxygen's great. It's good to have, especially at a high altitude, right? So the ramp opens all the way and you're standing on the foot of that ramp. You're the first guy. And, you know, the grizzly green beret standing next to you says, get out. And either you do or you fail. And, you know, in the special ops, failure is not really in our vocabulary. And I quit. Definitely not a couple words you're going to hear out of anyone. So I understand that by stepping foot off that ramp could mean death, you know, could mean catastrophic injury. But I step off. And so does every other man on that plane, because the military has conditioned us into, you know, thinking in a way that we acknowledge risk. I see it. I see the cactuses down there in the mountains and the desert and 13,000 feet between me and them and unknown of what's going to happen between then and then, right? It's not discounting all that stuff. It's acknowledging those risks and perils and what ifs and Murphy's laws. And it's mitigating them the best that we possibly can through training, through visualization, through education. But then when you're standing at the foot of the ramp, you have to make a decision. Is my mission, is what I'm doing in this life important enough to risk it all? And fortunately, in multifamily real estate, it's not stepping foot out of a C-130 going 150 miles an hour. That's pretty profound. We're talking about calling a broker on a phone and having a conversation, two human beings, about can we make a deal work? It's about talking to family members and friends, asking how the stock market is doing for them. Like, hey, I invest in commercial real estate and, you know, I've, you know, made these types of returns for my investors and they get a portion of the upside and a portion of the tax benefits. Is that something you'd be interested in? Is that freaking hard? It's really not. But, to a lot of people, they can't get over their fear. They can't get over the fear of rejection. They can't get over the fear of potentially losing some of their money, or, you know, tenants being a nightmare, or a pipe bursting, like I mentioned, or a fire or a death in a unit. That just happened to me last week, by the way. They think of all the things that could go wrong and none of the stuff that can go right. You know, they think, they see all the risks. What I think is a risk is, you know, being at retirement age, like, you know, my dad was in his 50s, and the company he'd been with for 20 years, deciding that three kids and, you know, my mom and him getting in, you know, in their 50s, it cost too much for health insurance, and they're going to hire somebody else right out of college. What do you assign for that risk? What do you assign that in 2007, you know, people of our parents' generations lost half of their wealth in the stock market? People were losing their homes left and right because of really bad lending practices on the single family side. And even if you were one of the smart people that didn't over leverage yourself and hung on, look at what your neighbors did on your behalf. How much of your wealth and everything that you lost versus no fault of your own. What's the risk of that? What's the risk of, you know, your spouse getting sick and you're working 60 hours a week and you can't even be there for the medical appointments, or God forbid something happens to one of your kids, or even if everything's going great with the kids, you're never there for baseball. You're working. You're never there to be the coach or to host the field trip or to have the sleepover. What's that like? What's that? What's the risk of that, looking back on your life and realizing that that's all you had? To me, the decision is abundantly clear. It's not even close. But I also understand that that muscle was developed for me through some very austere conditions within the special ops. Not everyone has the background that I have, but everyone has adversity. Everyone has stuff in life that didn't go the way that they wanted. And you know what? You're still freaking here. So if you decide that you want to do this thing, you have to decide. You have to cut off all other options of possibility. And every day you have to take one small step toward that goal. It's not going to happen next month. It might not happen next year. But I guarantee you, if you keep tuning in to listen to Reed and what, you know, he has to say, you go on Bigger Pockets, you get yourself a mentor, a coach, a peer group. Your network is your net worth. You know, if you surround yourself with the people that are doing it, you have no choice but to do it yourself.
Where would somebody get a hold of you?
If you need to get a hold of me, I mean, this is terrible to say, but the best way might even be Facebook. Phil Capron, PhilCapron. You know, I'm not the best at responding to messages, but I will see it and I'll get back to you at some point. Just friend me first, because a lot of them go to like the spam folder. I've got philcapron.com. It's sort of a landing page, doesn't really do much. I'm a senior mentor within the Michael Blanc organization, themichaelblanc.com. Check out his podcast. A lot of resources for free there. You'll see me at different multifamily events. But, you know, like I alluded to earlier when we were talking about the coaching students, I do this kind of stuff because I love it. And I love watching other people be able to have like this sort of aha moments and start to rack up some passive income the way that I've done. And, you know, so if that's you, you know, hit me up and I'm happy to have, you know, little chat, answer question here, there as I can. Just know that guys like Reed and I, you know, we're busy, we're doing deals, you know, we're not just hanging out. So don't be offended if it takes it, you know, a day or something for me to get back to you. But, you know, if something I said resonated, got any questions, you know, happy to talk to just about anyone. So.